meetings. The first thing we learned about successful change that had a real powerful effect on us was the fact that the leaders made change all about problem solving. Organizations have to change and do things differently when things are not working. Whether it's a revenue shortfall, exploding costs, poor customer service, or a lack of quality. And while all of these issues require change, the real issue is solving the problem. We learned that the word change can have a real negative connotation for a lot of people for the reasons I discussed earlier, and it tends to evoke fear and even resistance. But most people are pretty good at problem solving, as we do it in one form or another virtually every day of our lives. So characterizing change as problem solving helps people reframe and make the process seem less intimidating and much more achievable. A savvy leader who needs to make change will say, "We have a problem to solve, and I know that we can work together to find and implement a solution." Approaching change as a problem-solving activity is a powerful way for all of us to reframe both what we're going to do and why we're going to do it. The second really important thing we learned was that while leadership is essential to achieve organizational change, not just any leadership will do. Real and rapid change or problem solving requires leadership that is effective, trustworthy, and hands-on. And that means that you need the right person in charge of with the right qualities for the right change. In fact, the influence of leadership is so powerful that according to our participants, the person in charge of leading change was the single most important predictor of success. And given our review of Deutschman's findings, I think it's easy to see why this is the case. What qualities must a leader have to achieve change? Well, we found that leaders of successful change initiatives were focused, energized, skilled, and passionate about making things better. Conversely, failed efforts were almost always poorly led, with the person in charge often just going through the motions of the change effort that was mandated maybe by somebody else or undertaken largely for appearance sake or political posturing. We also found that successful change leaders were emotionally intelligent. They had great coaching and people skills, and they accepted change as a critically important and ongoing part of their leadership role. Successful change initiatives are led by people who have courage, persistence, confidence, and poise. To give you a word picture, successful change leaders demonstrate the characteristics of a good quarterback in American football. They're visible, calling the plays, taking charge, and controlling the pace of the contest. And successful change leaders are often called change agents, as they foster ownership of the improvement initiative. They don't waste time or resources. They make adjustments quickly. And in the words of many, they find a way to win. And it's important to note that participants in our study cited numerous examples of changes that looked impossible but succeeded because the leader and their people pulled together to solve the problem. It could be saving a key account, launching a new product, an organizational turnaround. Great change leaders know that if you're going to win, you win with people. In addition, effective change leaders clearly define what winning looks like. They do not start a change initiative without knowing and clearly defining the desired goals and outcomes for the effort. One of the more obvious attributes of successful change initiatives was the fact that going into any change effort, leaders and participants had come to the realization that performance on a specific performance dimension was not where it needed to be, that a problem existed, and that clearly defined goals and outcomes had to be established. So a successful change effort is driven in the pursuit of a very specific outcome, whether it's an increase in sales revenue, a reduction in cost structure, or fixing a broken process. This level of focus also enables a leader to know whether or not success is achieved. In contrast, unsuccessful change initiatives were replete with examples of changing for the sake of change, unclear expectations, and people just going through the motions because they were told to do something without being told why. The successful change initiatives we studied also had two other critically important qualities, a sense of urgency and speed. A sense of urgency conveys to people the importance of the effort. It can easily be translated into the need for speed, which then gives the effort forward momentum. While Cotter and other researchers have identified a sense of urgency as being a critical factor for successful change in previous research, we found it interesting that most successful change initiatives also employ speed, meaning that they typically happen sooner rather than later. It may be that it's simply easier to maintain high motivation and to keep people focused on a goal over a shorter period of time, and that people's focus diminishes over the course of an extended effort. Indeed, we found that unsuccessful change initiatives have no momentum. They drag on, and in many cases, they simply languish and go away, which means that they were either not important in the first place, or at least that poor leadership gave people that impression. Now, the next big finding was the one that took us by surprise, and it represented some new thinking on the subject of achieving organizational change. We found that leaders of successful change efforts take the time to know and understand what and whom they're up against when going into any change initiative. They determine how well their skill set and the skill set of their team stacks up against the challenge of change. One key component of this practice is evaluating everyone's past change efforts and the results that they produced. Another was taking the time to develop a scouting report to understand who might oppose one's change efforts. These opponents might be the organization's competitors, or they might be people in the accounting department or members of upper management. In the words of one participant in our study, it just makes sense to look at what you're getting into so you can see how you stack up against the problems that you have to solve. So in this regard, the next time you go into a change initiative, stop and review your performance on your most recent change initiative and compare what you learn with what you will be up against in your next change effort. Taking the time to do this can have a powerful impact on the success of your change effort. And please note, this gives you an opportunity to learn from your team members about how to correct mistakes that may have been made in the past in our efforts at change. Still, more vital elements of a successful change initiative are teamwork and talent. When you think about the problem-solving activities needed to drive change, it makes good sense that you need a motivated group of people who are able to work together and who have the requisite skill set for the needs of your project. Among other things, you probably need people with good IT skills, others who are good analysts, and people who have a good training and facilitation background. The power of a team to solve problems is often overlooked. Yet teams can be an invaluable source of ideas, innovation, and out-of-the-box thinking. And when a group of people are properly led, develop a change plan or a solution to a problem, the team member's sense of ownership over the implementation process goes up significantly. Also, don't forget the critical elements of training and coaching. You need to equip everyone on your team with the necessary skills to achieve the results that you're asking of them. If you don't, your change efforts are likely to produce nothing but frustration and substandard results. In keeping with Alan Deutschman's findings, we also found that an essential part of getting people to work as a team is having a well-defined game plan. A clear plan for reaching your objective that is known and understood by everyone involved in the process. If you're asked to implement an organizational change that has been created by someone else, then you must take the time to know and understand how this plan meets the needs of your operation. You must then find a way to explain that plan clearly so that everyone on your team understands it and his or her role within it. If instead you and your team members have to solve a problem and achieve a change on your own, make sure that you take the time to diagnose and clearly define the real problem. Identify courses of action that can solve the problem. Effectively analyze each option. Select and design your improvement plan and do a thorough job of planning how you are going to implement your action plan. Now, there are still two more important attributes of successful change efforts that are worth taking a good hard look at and shouldn't be overlooked. When it comes to the implementation of a change plan, we have found that successful change plans inevitably require careful monitoring. The leaders of successful plans observe and measure both individual and team performance to ensure that the right things are happening. If people know they're being held accountable for their behavior and performance, people will behave differently, just like the coronary bypass patients who are trying to develop healthier lifestyles. Where performance falls short, leaders need to make the necessary changes in methods, inputs, or personnel to get the results where they need to be. And that will encourage everyone to give the initiative his or her best effort. Finally, we found that successful leaders of organizational change provide feedback, coaching, and rewards to shape and reinforce the actions and behaviors that are driving the change. Careful monitoring enables a leader to know when desired results are being achieved and to call attention to them, which produces justifiable pride and satisfaction in the people whose hard work is making the change possible. If leaders do not engage in this important practice and learn how to celebrate success, it becomes more difficult for new behaviors to emerge and for people to keep their enthusiasm and focus where it needs to be. To sum up, it's very clear from our research that trustworthy leaders are in a great position to make real change happen. If you follow the important practices that we've identified, you can drive real, successful change in your organization too. Let's be honest. Organizational change usually isn't easy, and it requires a huge amount of effort on your part as a leader and on the part of everyone that you lead. But given that it needs to happen, and often when it's least convenient, plan for it carefully. And be sure to monitor the results to make sure that you hit the mark that you are aiming for. Remember, change is either worth doing right or it's pointless. So listen, learn, and lead well.
This lecture is titled Lifelong Learning for Career Success.
Intellectual growth should commence at birth and cease only at death. These powerful words were spoken by Albert Einstein, who makes a pretty strong case for the importance of lifelong learning. To begin this discussion, I want to start by applauding you for being serious about your own intellectual growth and your personal and professional development. I want to thank you for your willingness to take the time and effort to immerse yourself in this critical business skills course. As we begin this final installment of our investigation of organizational behavior, let me ask you a very straightforward question. What have you learned during this course? What have you really learned about creating people power and improving human capital in the workplace? Now, when I talk about learning, I'm not talking about the simple transfer of information from me to you, or having some new ideas about some work-related issue, or being able to temporarily recite a fact or a figure or a research study. We have to be careful not to mistake information exchange with learning. And this is especially true when we talk about organizational behavior. What we have learned about organizational behavior needs to impact both our thought processes and the way we behave to be of any real value. And to illustrate this important point, we've all seen and worked with managers and professionals with lots of information and head knowledge that never translated into effective behavior on the job. So while they may have had useful information, this information did not impact their performance, which is what real organizational behavior learning is all about. So when I use the word learning here, I'm talking about a relatively permanent and real change in the level of knowledge that you possess that can guide and direct your thinking and ultimately impact your behavior. And hopefully, this learning will help you improve a particular skill set that gives you greater confidence to do the things that bring out the best in the people around you. You see, real learning around the topics that we've discussed is learning that improves your ability to do things more effectively with the people you depend on at work. And when we talk about the link between lifelong learning and development, it's all about making real learning an ongoing part of your professional and personal lifestyle. Always remember that, as a study I conducted made clear, the number one factor for career success and survival is having a track record of delivering desired results for your employer. But another critical factor highlighted by my study is your ability to continually develop your skills and talents to meet the changing demands of your job. And it's easy to see why. In our brave new data-driven world, information is doubling every 5 years. And organizations are rapidly changing to keep up with the hyper-dynamic marketplace. Performance expectations keep being ratcheted up, and the average worker will change jobs between 7 and 10 times during his or her career. So it should come as no surprise that we must all make lifelong learning and professional development a real priority. Your workplace relevance and your career success and survival depend on it. It's important to note that the onus and responsibility for developing yourself falls squarely on your shoulders. While your boss and organization can help guide you and provide important input and resources, it really comes down to your willingness to take control of this important part of your work life. It's critical to remember that delivering better results for your organization requires improving your talent. And improving your talent requires two things: ongoing learning and professional development. And while this may sound simple, we know that learning can be quite challenging and in some cases even painful. So in today's discussion, we're going to talk about the barriers that get in the way of our ability to learn and develop and how to overcome them. And lots of my research clearly demonstrates that successful people across virtually every discipline tend to be lifelong learners who place a real priority on their intellectual and professional development. Whether it's a senior leader sharing in an interview the importance and need of having an executive coach, or a middle manager being actively engaged in their trade association to learn what other companies are doing in their industry on a survey, or a frontline supervisor making the case for taking the time to attend a leadership workshop, regardless of the industry, organizational level, or research methodology employed, the importance of continuous learning quickly emerges as a requirement for organizational success and advancement. So here's a question that HR people, human capital consultants, trainers, business coaches, people developers, and learning specialists ask all the time. Why don't people take their professional development more seriously? Or stated somewhat differently, what are the primary barriers that prevent or damage a person's ability to learn in the workplace? To explore this important issue in detail, I asked a large sample of business leaders to identify the specific factors that get in the way of people's ability to learn and develop at work. and there were some pretty distinctive patterns that quickly emerged. Participants described learning and development barriers that were a function of extreme time pressure, bad bosses, and the fact that lots of people receive little or no performance feedback. Without feedback, they didn't know or understand their skill deficiencies, so they felt no real need to change. Other key factors made it clear that learning and development were stifled by organizational cultures that did not promote or even encourage employee development, or organizations demonstrated a willingness to accept poor performance and the status quo, so there was now accountability or pressure for improvement. And in a number of cases, people worked at companies that failed to invest resources and create processes to promote learning. Another finding of the study was that many people don't take the time for self-reflection and self-appraisal. The simple fact is that some people are just not interested in learning and improving themselves. They are kind of just plain stuck where they're at, and that's it. Finally, participants made it pretty clear that out-of-control egos and hubris can prevent people from realizing that they are less than perfect and in need of some work. Now let me ask you a question. Are there things that get in the way of your learning and professional development at work? If you're like the rest of us, the answer is almost always a resounding yes. We all face barriers that can get in the way of acquiring new skills to meet the demands of our job, or refine our existing talents, or developing greater expertise in an area that can really help advance our careers. So what can happen if you don't overcome the barriers that prevent us from learning and developing ourselves to meet the changing demands of our job? Well, let me just say this. It can get pretty ugly. Several years ago, on a Friday afternoon, there was a knock at my office door. When I opened the door, I was shocked to see the CEO of an organization I had just done some senior level consulting work for, looking as if he hadn't slept for a couple days, or maybe he had just been in an automobile accident. His eyes were red and puffy, his hair was disheveled, his tie was askew, and he was sweating profusely. I invited him in, and he fell into a chair, and I said, "So what's going on?" And he looked at me and said, "I just got fired, and I can't believe it." Over the course of the next 2 hours, he went on to explain how the chairman of the board had just let him go as his management style and his skill set were no longer a good fit for the corporation, and it was time for him to move on. The chairman had stung him when he said, "You just don't act or think like a CEO." He had been promoted from within the organization into the CEO position 3 years earlier, and he admitted that he was struggling to become more strategic, build an effective senior leadership team, and make real improvement happen. And then he said, "I've been so busy trying to get things done to make things work, I probably didn't pick up on the cues that were coming. If I had, maybe I could have done something to stop it." As we analyzed the CEO's tenure, it became pretty clear that his skills were not up to speed in several critical areas. The sad part was that he knew he had not taken proactive steps to better equip himself with the talent he needed to be successful in his new role. Could he have salvaged his situation? Well, we'll never know. But we do know that he did not work to overcome the barriers that prevented him from developing the talents he needed to meet the demands of his extremely challenging job. And the cost for his inaction was huge, both personally and professionally. So how do we all avoid going down this path with our careers? Well, the first step is to make it a habit of engaging in ongoing learning. It's been said that we all have an opportunity to learn each and every day of our lives if we're paying attention to the things going on around us. And I believe that this is absolutely true. So let's assume for a moment that you've taken the time to address your situation. You can do that by conducting the kind of strategic stop that we discussed earlier in this lecture series. And you've identified the results that you're being paid to deliver and the actions that will help you deliver those results, the key relationships necessary for success, and where you need to invest your time for success. Let's assume that you and your boss are on the same page in this regard. So all in all, you're in pretty good spot to deliver desired results. Okay, what will allow ongoing learning to take place in your work life to help you stay on track? Well, if you talk to high-performance leaders from our research, they'll tell you some very important things in this regard. First, it's imperative that you and I take time each and every day to reflect on what is going on and how you're going to do it. This means that we become more self-monitoring and self-aware of our behavior, which is the cornerstone of an emotionally intelligent person. And in this regard, it's really important that we conduct a daily stop in order to spend sufficient time planning and developing our performance script for each day. When we have an action plan in place, we then have a great opportunity for learning when we take our midday and end of the day stop time to review what was done, what was not completed, and what lessons we have learned. High-performance business leaders will tell you that daily self-appraisal is one of the most important things necessary for ongoing learning. And without it, it's easy for all of us to become ineffectual. Or stated differently, we might find ourselves being really busy without being effective. It's imperative that we all take time each and every day to think and reflect. Secondly, it's imperative that we seek out and receive ongoing feedback from the people around us who are in a position to help us improve our skills. Our research tells us that lots of professionals do not get sufficient feedback and coaching on their performance. So we need to become more proactive in this regard. As our terminated CEO shared with me, he didn't really get a lot of specific feedback about his ongoing performance. Is there anything stopping you from setting up a regular performance alignment and feedback session a couple of times a month with your boss to make sure that you're properly focused and doing the things that are needed the right way? Is there anything stopping you from asking your direct reports for anonymous feedback on the usefulness of a recent meeting or the effectiveness of a current project that you are leading? Is there anything stopping you from seeking out input from a trusted coworker about what you might do to become more effective in your current role? If your organization is not providing you with satisfactory feedback and you need to create your own feedback mechanisms, if you're going to be in a position to continuously improve your talent and your performance. Leadership expert Dr. Ken Blanchard has described feedback as the breakfast of champions. And he's right in that feedback is like jet fuel for learning and change. If we take the time to build great 360-degree working relationships, the opportunities to get accurate feedback and candid feedback go up significantly. Thirdly, it's imperative that we learn from our mistakes and we do not allow them to become habits or lifestyle. Socrates once said, "The ongoing challenges of life mandates applying all our wisdom to daily situations lest we fall prey to our own folly." Socrates was telling us that it's important to apply our learning, or what he calls wisdom, to situations so that we don't get caught up in foolishness. And he's absolutely right. The problem here is that there's a good chance that we won't remember what Socrates said. But there's a very good chance that you'll remember the words of the great American film actor John Wayne when he said, "Life is tough, but it's tougher if you're stupid." Now, I sure hope this doesn't come off as being offensive, but when we make the same mistake time and time again, it means that we are not learning. You see, an ignorant person does not know what to do. A person is being stupid, though, when he knows what to do and for whatever reason doesn't do it. For any of us, doing stupid things can damage our performance, our credibility, our character, and our career. And when we find ourselves making the same mistake time and time again, we not only damage performance, but worse yet, the mistake can easily become a deep-rooted habit. Maybe it's running a poor meeting, or allowing your temper to get the best of you, or failing to communicate effectively with your boss, or constantly biting off more than you can chew, or not doing many of the things that we've discussed during this lecture series. Ongoing learning means that we learn from our mistakes on an ongoing basis, and this requires self-monitoring, reflection, and thinking rather than simply reacting to given situations. Fourthly, ongoing learning can take place when we make seeking out new and better ways of doing things part of our daily work routine and our approach to work. There's much to learn by learning how to ask good questions and by sharpening our listening skills. There's much to learn by working closely with talented people and learning how to emulate their thinking and behavior. There's much to learn by reading newspapers and periodicals that can help us with information about current industry trends and best practices that are relevant to our jobs. And there's much to learn when we have great working relationships to draw upon when we have a question or we need input in solving a problem or we simply need a sounding board for an important decision that we are about to make. Engaging in all these practices on an ongoing basis can have a powerful effect on our ongoing learning. Finally, leaders and professionals who are serious about ongoing learning will create accountability systems for themselves that motivate and encourage them to engage in many of the practices that we have discussed during this course, as to do some things that might be outside of our comfort zone possibly. If you remember our discussion on change, having accountability was a critical component for getting coronary bypass patients to adopt healthier lifestyles. People who are serious about ongoing learning will have regular contact with an accountability partner, or they may go so far as to set up a personal board of directors. This accountability on a regular basis is great for discussing the things we need to keep doing, the things we need to stop doing, and the things we need to start doing to improve our performance. Ongoing accountability, feedback, and counsel can be invaluable for ongoing learning, growth, and professional development. And I would be remiss in this discussion of ongoing learning if I didn't share this simple thought with you. And it's so very important. Stay humble and maintain a teachable spirit. Ego, hubris, arrogance are the enemy of ongoing learning, and they can poison our ability to accurately assess our talents and our willingness to learn from others. The second major step to keep yourself growing in your career is to adopt smart professional development practices that will improve your talent. While ongoing learning practices can go a long way to improving our performance, from time to time, we all need to conduct a strategic stop to assess if our talent base is where it needs to be. And if it's not, we need to figure out what we need to be doing and what we are going to do about it ASAP. Once again, let's draw upon the collective wisdom of high-performance leaders that I surveyed to see what they do to develop professionally. First, it's really important that you take the time to look in the mirror and conduct a needs assessment to determine your level of proficiency on the skills that are most important for your success in your current position. And there's a good chance when you've had your most recent formal performance appraisal that your boss identified an area or two that could use some work. So stop right now and name one skill that you think you need to develop to become more effective in your job and maybe less stressed out. Is it a technical skill tied to your job? Or is it your ability to plan effectively or build a team or coach your people or lead an organizational improvement effort? So what's the skill you'd like to improve upon? Now, I want to ask you a question, and I don't want you to laugh. Is there anything stopping you from developing world-class talent around the skill that you see as your greatest deficiency? No, I'm being serious. And this takes us to the next step in the process. Once a deficiency has been identified, it's imperative to set a specific learning objective for that particular skill. And the more specific, the better. You want to clearly state the learning goal to create focus and attach a time frame to it in order to create action. You may say, I want to learn how to delegate work to employees more effectively and efficiently in the next 60 days. Or, I want to improve my tactical planning skills in the next 30 days. Or you might be really bold and say, in the next year, I want to become the leading authority in my organization on fill in the blank. Whatever the skill is, you need to identify it and attach a time frame to the goal. You need to come to the realization that there is very little that is stopping you from developing world-class talent around any skill that you deem critical for your success. Now, once you set clear learning objectives, it's important to create an improvement plan to help you develop the skills that you need to be more successful. In studying the learning practices of high-performance professionals, we found that they craft development plans that are specific to the skills they're trying to perfect, and they have lots of tools to draw upon. Now, a lot of us sit back and wait for the outcome of our annual performance review to take action in this regard. But I want to encourage you to be more proactive and go into your next performance review with your professional development plan already in place and in action. I think your boss will be pleasantly surprised and maybe even impressed. And in developing your plan, you might want to seek out formal training and educational programs around a particular skill that needs work. And these days, there's a huge variety of formal training and educational programs that we can put to use. Start by familiarizing yourself with the organizational training and development programs that your own company offers. In many cases, formal learning opportunities are right under our noses and we don't even know it. Or you might be able to find a seminar or workshop offered by a consulting group or a university or a community college right in your own backyard. And the neat part is that we have lots of online and digital options available to us, including the great courses. In the information age, we have tremendous access to everything we might possibly want to learn if we're serious about finding it. But make sure to do your homework on the course or program to make sure that it's worth the time, the effort, and the money spent, and that it's directly tied to the skill you're trying to develop. And after completing a formal education program like this, make sure that you do the things that increase your ability to retain and apply this important information. Include some specific actions from the training that you can make part of your STOP process that are directly tied to getting better results. Or, when you return to work, provide the members of your team with a summary of what was learned and how some of these ideas might be applied. Or maybe be really bold and come back to work and teach a class on the topic yourself. Information without application will not create transformation or provide you with a return on your investment. Now, when you formulate your talent improvement plan, remember that there's a great deal to be gained by using experience-based learning as well. Within your organization, things like cross-training or learning skills that those around you use in their jobs, or taking on special assignments to serve on an improvement team or a task force, and special on-the-job training programs are just a few of the things that you might consider looking at for on-the-job learning opportunities. In addition, organization-sponsored community service and outreach projects and volunteering in your community can be an amazing development opportunity for people who are interested in accelerating their personal growth and development. Now, Just as in the case of your ongoing learning, once you've taken the time to create your professional development plan, it is really important that you create accountability around it. And here's where having a great working relationship with your boss, having an accountability partner, or having a personal board of directors can come in handy yet again. For your development plan to work, there must be specific action, ongoing feedback and reinforcement, and accountability for action, or the hustle and bustle of our daily work routines will squeeze out these important learning opportunities. Developing yourself with the skills and talent you need might be the single most important lesson that you can take away from this course. Now, to conclude this session and course, I've saved a really important topic. I want to briefly discuss the importance of being a mentor and being willing to mentor others. And while the term mentor is very popular and often misused, it's important to note that very few people know the origin of the word. The story of mentor comes from Greek mythology, in fact, from Homer's Odyssey. When Odysseus, king of Ithaca, was called away to fight in the Trojan War, he entrusted the care and protection of his household and his son, Telemachus, to a friend named Mentor. Mentor was trusted by the king to be a teacher, guardian, counselor, coach, protector, and overseer to Telemachus. And he served in those roles with great care and affection. Today, the word mentor means roughly the same thing, a person whom we consider to be a trusted teacher, advisor, friend, and wise counselor. You should never underestimate the power of having a mentor and being a mentor. Successful people almost always have a network of mentors to help them make good decisions, plan more effectively, and create and maintain professional networks. And successful people know that mentoring other people helps them keep their feet firmly planted on the ground, causes them to stay humble, and keeps them connected to the things going on around them. As we move through life pursuing our careers, it's critically important to remember that relationships are the cornerstone of our careers and the foundation of life. Each of us needs to take responsibility for being an effective mentor to the people around us, the people who are less fortunate than ourselves, and the people who have something to be gained by having access to our experience, counsel, support, and network. At the same time, each of us needs to have a mentor in our lives for the same reasons. And given the importance of this practice, maybe this is the expertise that each one of us might set the goal of developing world-class talent around. I can tell you with great certainty that I would not be where I am today without the mentoring of a great many people at various stages of my life. So make sure that you have a mentor in your life to help turn your thoughts into action and your actions into success. And whether it's improving your leadership skills, developing your emotional intelligence, improving your coaching or team building skills, or developing any of the other skills that we have discussed, make use of that special mentoring relationship to develop the knowledge and talents that are most critical to your success. It's been my distinct privilege to be able to share this course with you, and thanks for being great lifelong learners. So listen, learn, and lead well.
These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. These lectures are titled Critical Business Skills, Marketing. Your lecturer is Dr. Ryan Hamilton. Dr. Hamilton is an associate professor of marketing at Emory University's Goizueta Business School, where he has taught since 2008. He received his Ph.D. in marketing from Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. Dr. Hamilton is a consumer psychologist whose research investigates shopper decision-making, how brands, prices, and choice architecture influence decision-making at the point of purchase. His findings have been published in some of the most prestigious peer-reviewed journals in marketing and management, and have been covered in the popular press, including the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Time, and USA Today. This lecture is titled, What is Marketing?
In early 2003, McDonald's suffered its first ever quarterly loss. Same-store sales had been declining for 12 straight months, and the things McDonald's had been trying to turn things around, well, they just weren't working. Many people thought the solution for McDonald's was to start offering healthier foods. People were getting more health conscious after all. The book Fast Food Nation had come out just a few years before. Supersize Me, that was just around the corner. Eating healthier and railing against unhealthy fast foods were part of the cultural zeitgeist. So, McDonald's should introduce some healthier foods. But how could it pull something like that off? McDonald's had tried many times in the past to introduce healthier items to their food menu, and every time they'd met with failure. Do you remember the McLean Deluxe or the McSalad Shakers? Yeah, probably not. They weren't around very long. Nobody bought them. So, what would you do? If McDonald's hired you to introduce a healthier food item to their menu, one that people would actually order, one that would actually improve sales, what would you develop? Does this sound like a fun problem to solve? Welcome to the exciting world of marketing. If McDonald's had any hope of developing a healthier food item that people would actually buy, it had to start by figuring out to whom it will be selling that particular item. And what does that particular group of people want? And this is where marketing comes in. The biggest mistake people make in thinking about marketing is to define it too narrowly. Many firms treat marketing as something that is done after a product's been developed and simply needs to be sold. They essentially treat marketing as just advertising and just sales. According to this view, McDonald's should go into their food labs, use the latest in fast food science, whip up something healthy, and then they should contact the marketing department. And their job would just be to push that newly developed food onto customers. You know, design a cute commercial. Maybe something with dancing vegetables. But if that's how you are using marketing, you are fighting with both hands tied behind your back. Marketing's job is to create value for customers. Not just to communicate value that's already been created. And marketing does this by understanding who the customer is, what they value, and how they can deliver that value better than the competition. In this way, marketing is the most important discipline in business, says the marketing professor humbly. But you don't have to take my word for it. The management guru Peter Drucker once famously said, "Business has only two functions, marketing and innovation." So there you go. That was Peter Drucker. And to his wisdom, I would add that to the extent that many of the most important business innovations are actually customer-facing, new ways of providing even more value to customers, marketing is even an important part of innovation, too. So marketing is the most important discipline in business. I should pause here to note that this definition of marketing as the function of a business that creates value, this is not a definition that's accepted by everyone, even within business schools. My first year of teaching, I had an MBA student interrupt my class during the semester to tell me that the day before, when their economics professor had asked them about the purpose of marketing, this student had dutifully repeated my preferred definition of marketing, telling the econ professor, "Marketing is what creates value for customers." The econ professor laughed at him. He told the student that was ridiculous. Value, he said, is created by innovations, which happen in a lab. Value is created by scientists and engineers. Value is most definitely not created by marketers. I think the disagreement between my economist colleague and me was rooted in a difference of opinion over what constitutes value from a business perspective. I think that he, along with very many other smart people, view value as something intrinsic to the offering. So if you take an offering and add a feature, or give it a faster processor, or make it more fuel efficient or more powerful, then you are increasing the value of that offering. Which makes sense. Only I think it's not correct. From a business perspective, adding some new feature or improving some attribute will only increase the value of the offering if some group of customers decide that they value that improvement. In fact, there are settings in which removing features can actually make customers like something more. In other words, I am arguing that for businesses, an offering's value should be determined only from the perspective of the customers who are willing to buy it. And if we use this customer-centric definition of value, then we understand that innovations developed in a lab are not intrinsically valuable. Those innovations need to be matched with a set of customers who actually appreciate them. And those innovations need to then be explained to customers in a way that they will understand them. And then they need to be priced in such a way that those customers will be willing to pay for them, and then sold in locations where the customers are willing to buy them. And all of those decisions are functions of marketing. In other words, marketing is what turns something with the potential for creating value into something that actually creates value for the customer and for the company selling it. I know that some of you are already arguing with me. Some of you are saying, surely, some innovations are so great, so much better than what's already out there, that people just recognize the value without any of this marketing trickery. I'm also willing to bet that many of you who are saying something like that are engineers of some kind. Yeah, that's okay. I love teaching engineers. Occasionally, it is possible for there to be an innovation that is just so great that people flock to it, and it just sells itself. Perhaps you can think of some examples where this happened. But it's also distressingly common for groundbreaking innovations to fail the first time out to the market, and then for another company to come along later, mimic the innovation, but market it better, and create a runaway success. Let me tell you a story. Way back in the 1980s, Apple created the world's first tablet computer. It was called the Apple Newton. It was small. It was a handheld device about the size of a really fat Kindle. It had an interactive touchscreen display, and it was, for its time, by all accounts, a technological marvel. You could use it as a datebook, as a calendar, contact file, word processor, calculator, and spreadsheet program. It also had a very advanced and flexible database program. It could interface with all of the existing database software on the market. Later models even had a type of wireless connectivity. It could send and receive faxes. The Newton was a marvel, but there's a good chance you've never even heard of it, because despite its technological superiority, it failed in the marketplace. In spite of all it could do, people didn't buy it because it was marketed poorly. People didn't recognize its value, didn't know what to do with it, and couldn't figure out how to fit it into their lives. A few years later, Motorola developed a product called the Envoy, and this was even more advanced than the Newton. The scientists and engineers at Motorola Labs added even more features. It could do most of the things the Newton could do, but the Envoy could also connect to cell networks, which meant you could make and receive calls from this device. And this was in 1994. Groundbreaking. Very advanced stuff. The Envoy also failed. Then, in 1996, a company called Palm comes along and releases the Palm Pilot. And the Palm Pilot blew this market wide open. So here's the question. How did Palm crack this nut when Apple and Motorola and also Tandy and also something called the Go Corporation and others had all failed to make headway in this market? Did they go out and make something even more advanced? Did Palm make something even more cutting edge? Did they have even more brilliant engineers burning even more of the midnight oil? No. Palm started by understanding their eventual customer and the specific problems they were trying to solve for that specific person. In other words, they started with marketing. And their marketing guided every decision they made along the way. How big should we make this thing? Well, how big does the customer want it to be? How many features should we add? How many functions does the customer want it to have? What kinds of software does the customer need? They didn't solve these problems in a lab and then take it out to the marketplace and try to sell it. They started by understanding their eventual customer and making all decisions accordingly. Before electronic personal digital assistants, business was conducted in the age of the Franklin Planner. These were book-sized, leather-bound monstrosities that contained all of a person's contacts and their calendar and their to-do lists. And sometimes, Franklin Planners would get lost, which was worse in many ways than if the person had lost an appendage. This would throw a business person's world into chaos. If you were a traveling salesperson and you lost your planner, you may have just lost all of your appointments for the next several months, as well as many of your contacts. It was a disaster. Yes, yes, people were encouraged to back up their planners by making photocopies, but really, who does something like that? So, in this marketplace, along comes Palm. And instead of including advanced database management and word processing and fax capabilities, they actually introduced a less advanced handheld device. It essentially did one thing. It was an electronic version of a Franklin Planner that would automatically back itself up every time it was plugged into your computer. So if you ever lost your Palm, all you needed to do was buy a new one, and then you hot sync it to your computer, you're back up and running. That was it. A less advanced product that created more value for the customers through marketing. Value should always be defined through the eyes of the customer. And that is where marketing comes in. How well did that work? Well, there were several years in the mid to late 90s where PDAs were a standard issue for everyone in business. Everyone had one of these things. It was common to have one clipped to your belt, alongside a clamshell cell phone, sometimes also a pager. We all looked like Batman in the 90s. So, how can we do what Palm did? How can we figure out what customers will value before we develop a product or service? Well, that's the question we'll be trying to answer in the rest of this course. Let's go ahead and dip our toe in the water right now. One way to figure out what your customer will value is to ask yourself, do I like this? And then assume that if you like it, then your customer will probably also like it too. Easy. Easy and almost always wrong. I don't know anything about you, obviously, but the fact that you are listening to me talk right now makes me feel pretty sure you're dissimilar to the average American in some pretty important ways. People are different, and the type of people who wind up making marketing decisions about products and services are usually different from the types of people they're trying to sell stuff to. Not better, different. And if you're going to be successful in marketing, you will need to respect and try to understand those differences. So that's the first rule of trying to understand your customers. Remember that you are almost certainly not your customer. You may be older or younger. You may be more or less educated. You may have more or less tolerance for risk. You're definitely smarter and better looking than your customers, right? And you're clearly more tolerant of flagrant attempts at flattery. So there are differences. But your preferences are probably just not that relevant here. So what can we do instead? If introspection is likely a dead end, what are the alternatives? One useful way of trying to figure out what customers will value is to recognize that there are different types of value that customers can get from an offering, and that for any particular customer, those different types of value are going to vary in terms of importance. I want to examine four types of value in particular: functional, monetary, social, and psychological. Functional value is what an offering does, its purpose, the solution it provides to a customer's problem. So the functional value associated with a car is that it can get you from point A to point B. The functional value of a bottle of water is that it quenches your thirst and hydrates you. Products and services differ in terms of their functional value to the extent that they're better at fulfilling their functional purpose. One floor cleaner can provide more functional value than another if it cleans floors better, or in less time, or with less effort than another floor cleaner. The second potential source of value that customers can derive from an offering is monetary value. Monetary value is a function of the price paid for an offering relative to its overall perceived worth to the customer. As such, monetary value is not a completely distinct form of value from the other sources of value. Rather, it invites a trade-off between those other types of value and the monetary costs. Monetary value can provide a very compelling reason for choice. A third source of value is social. Sometimes, owning a particular product allows consumers to connect with other people. If you've ever had someone strike up a conversation with you over the type of computer you're using, the type of hat you're wearing, type of motorcycle you're driving, then you have experienced social value. The fourth source of value is psychological. People use products and services to express themselves and to make themselves feel better. Sometimes all customers want out of an exchange is to feel appreciated or respected. Sometimes people are looking to feel comforted or secure or hopeful. The key insight here is not just that people derive value from these four different sources, but that these sources of value are not equally important all the time to all consumers. In fact, how important each source of value is will depend on the consumer and on the purchase. So the first question to ask yourself is, what will drive my customers' purchases? What type of value are they seeking? When shopping for a washing machine, for example, many customers might be all about functional value, wanting something that's energy efficient and reliable and that will actually get their clothes clean. When buying office supplies, on the other hand, some group of customers might primarily be driven by monetary value, making sure they get a good deal. Not necessarily buying the lowest priced offering available, but making sure they're getting a great price on whatever they get. Still other purchases may be driven by securing social value. Remember those questionable fashion choices you made in junior high because everyone else was sporting that style? Because you wanted to be like the cool kids and all the cool kids were wearing those types of clothes, for example? Or your customers might be motivated by psychological value, by the desire to express themselves, like that tattoo you got in college because you were so sure you would love Marky Mark and the Funky Bunch forever, and you wanted to make sure that everyone around you would always know that. On a more serious note, maybe your customers are motivated by a desire to feel secure or comforted. Purchasing a generous life insurance policy provides peace of mind because it's comforting to think that your family will be well provided for if the worst should happen. So the key is to figure out which source of value your customers are seeking in the particular transaction you're interested in. If you've miscalibrated and you think your customers want one thing, say monetary value, when they're primarily interested in something else, say psychological value, you may be wasting your marketing efforts. Consider the example given by the contemporary American philosopher Jerome Seinfeld in an early episode of his 1990s sitcom. A dry cleaner has just shrunk one of Jerry's shirts, and Jerry returns to the establishment to seek some recompense. When shown the shirt, the dry cleaner goes on the defensive, demanding to see a sales receipt, wanting to know how he knows whether it was his shop that did the shirt. The dry cleaner digs in because he thinks his customer only cares about monetary value. And in his mind, he assumes the only thing that will satisfy this customer is money. A refund, a credit, something that will cut into his store's bottom line. And so, not wanting to get ripped off by his customers, he decides to hold the line. But the dry cleaner doesn't understand what is motivating his customer in this case, which is crucial because this misunderstanding limits his possible tactics for dealing with this dissatisfied customer. Suppose Jerry is not motivated primarily by monetary value. Might there be some other response that would make him happy, or at least less mad? Jerry responds to the dry cleaner. What? You think this is some kind of scam I'm running? I take this tiny shirt all over the city, try to convince dry cleaners to give me money? Look at this thing. It's a hand puppet. In fact, forget about the money. For once, I would just like a dry cleaner to admit they made a mistake. I want an admission of guilt. Having been wronged and subsequently stonewalled by dry cleaners in the past, this customer is primarily looking for psychological value. He wants to be respected. A straightforward apology and a sincere promise to fix the problem might have gone over even better than a refund, grudgingly given, and only after the paperwork is filled out in triplicate. It is true, some people are rapacious bargain seekers and will take you for everything they can. But you shouldn't necessarily assume that your customers are primarily motivated by monetary value, or even by functional value. Both of these are important sources of value, and often they are in fact the most important things consumers consider. But not always. Let me give you an example. It turns out that the psychological value that comes from feeling respected and empowered is not limited to sales exchanges. In a radical departure from decades